Welcome to the Jerry Ratcliffe Show with Chris Graham.
Welcome to the show. This is going to be a fun one. I'm Chris Graham, joined by Jerry Ratcliffe. And Jerry, playing through the Rolodex here of great guests you can bring to the podcast. You got a really special one for us this week. So go ahead, Jerry. It's great to talk to you. I haven't talked to you for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, it's good linking up again. I know you battled a little down for the count under the weather for a while there. I'm glad to see you back at full strength.
Yeah, I'm glad to be back too. Yes, sir.
We do have a special guest today, and one guy that I've admired for ever since he moved, well, even before he moved to Albemarle County, I guess, knew well about him and his work. He really doesn't need any introduction, but he is a world-renowned writer, one of my favorite writers of all time, maybe the number one writer of all time, actually. And we're going to talk to him today about a lot of different sports. He's a huge sports fan. We'll lead off talking about his recent book, Sully, is about a different kind of court. He's usually writing about the legal courts. This time we're talking about a basketball court.
Yeah.
John Grisham. John, how are you? Thanks for joining us.
Fine, Jerry. Great to be here again, as always. Fun to talk sports with you, and hope you're doing well.
Doing well. Hanging in there. Let's jump right into the Sully book. I can imagine how that's being greeted worldwide, since it's about a 17-year-old kid in war-torn South Sudan and ends up in the United States. I'm not going to give a lot away, and I'll let you reveal as much as you prefer to. This must have taken, I know you are a master researcher for your books, but this one must have taken a different kind of path since you were in a different part of the world and had to see what it was like for a 17-year-old in a place like that growing up and trying to escape his poverty.
It's one of the more rewarding parts of this career, is to be able to pick a place or pick a topic or a person and do the research and go there if I have to. I didn't go to South Sudan because the State Department right now says don't go there. It's like the second most dangerous place in the world to go to. You don't want to visit it. Also, because of COVID, I couldn't go there. I read a lot of books. I read a lot of books about South Sudan, books written by journalists and politicians and historians. The best books were written by refugees, people who got out, some barely got out, and they made it here, where they have a lot of relatives, or they made it to the UK or someplace where they found a home and managed to survive. And their stories are hard to believe. The great NBA player, Lawal Deng, barely got out with his parents when he was a kid. I mean, there was gunfire. It was a very close call. He went to the UK, discovered the game of basketball. He played one and done at Duke in 2007, top NBA draft pick, and, you know, was an all-star. So there've been some great stories like that out of Africa. And I was inspired by all of that. I knew a lot of that background. And I also, in reading, I read some articles about these summer showcase teams that come here from around the world. And these kids are thrilled to be here, and they dream of being scouted by American coaches and maybe getting a scholarship to an American school. That's their dream. And it's they're fun to read about. That was good research, enjoyable. The history of South Sudan is very painful to read about. It's tragic. And the ongoing refugee crisis is a humanitarian disaster. There are more refugees today than yesterday. These South Sudanese people are scattered all over Africa in camps that are where they barely survive. They barely have enough to eat. They barely have enough health care. And it doesn't take much research to get a clear picture of how dire the situation is. But anyway, it's very dramatic, and that means it's very visual, and it's very compelling to read about because of all the suffering. Anywhere you have great suffering, you have great fiction, because of the human conflict. And so that was kind of the research that I put together to write the story. I was also inspired by Mamadi Diakite. He didn't inspire me to write the book, but we watched that kid for 4 years here. And when he came here, he didn't play much and their expectations were pretty low. He came here from Ghana, but he seemed to keep growing and getting better. And you could jump over the backboard. And then he started dyeing his hair orange and white and green. And he always played with his big infectious smile. And he was having fun on the court, and we just kind of fell in love with him. Remarkably, he became a very good player, was drafted by the Bucks and is now on the roster. So he's all the way in the NBA and still getting better. So he was part of the inspiration for the story.
That's pretty cool. I know you have written a couple of sports books before, but what made you decide to go, off your path and write another sports book, particularly one about a basketball player? I know you mentioned some of your inspirations, but what was your original thought?
You know, Jerry, I love to write the short sports novels. I wrote 15 years ago, I published Bleachers about high school football. And those novels are about 50,000 words. Calico Joe was 10 years, I'm sorry, Playing for Pizza came next, another football book about American football in Italy. That was a lot of fun to go research. I gained 20 pounds in Italy, all the food and drinking all the wine. About 7 years ago, I published Calico Joe because I love baseball. I wanted to publish a baseball novel. So, it's a great diversion for me from these pretty heavy stories about lawyers, courts, trials, judges, things like that. That's the bread and butter. That's what I write every year because I enjoy writing them. But the sports books are just a wonderful way to escape for me as a writer to put together, if the story works, if I have a good story, to put it together and to do the research. And so I've always, I've always wanted to write a basketball novel. Baseball has a very rich literary tradition in this country. There are a lot of great baseball novels. And that's because baseball the history of baseball tracks the history of America. And that's why there's so many great baseball stories. Football to a lesser extent. When I started looking for great basketball novels, I couldn't find any. There are a lot of great books. They're all nonfiction. And so my goal was to try to write a really fun, popular, maybe great, I don't know, I can't judge them, a basketball novel. And so, and I know the sport. You see us at the UVA games. We're there courtside for almost every home game. Our son went to UVA. We're big Wahoo fans. We love Tony and his kids and his program. My wife is a Tar Heel. She pulls for UVA every game except one. my daughter went to UNC. She's a Tar Heel. My daughter married a Tar Heel. And they've since produced two small Tar Heels. So, they're all in Raleigh and they're going to be Tar Heels. So we get a lot of basketball in the wintertime and we go to most of the home games in Chapel Hill. So we're back and forth. And from December through March, our whole world is pretty much, when's the next game? We love the ACC in basketball. We're always following other teams. In the wintertime, there's not much else to do but watch great basketball, and we're so happy. And another great advantage to living here in Central Virginia is we get ACC basketball. All those factors kind of came together to create this desire to write a basketball novel, and that's how it happened.
If you could, John, the South Sudan part, all the research there, all your background with ACC, UVA, UNC, you chose to set the basketball part of Suli. Not at the Power 5 level, not in the ACC, but at North Carolina Central, off the beaten path. Talk about the decision to do that.
Yeah, it's as you follow the story, Suli comes here. Suli is the kid's name is Samuel Suleiman. Suleiman's a fairly common name in East Africa. And I'd seen it before. I changed the spelling to suit myself because I write fiction. I can do that and get by with it. And so but Suli quickly becomes his nickname. When he gets here as a 17-year-old kid on the summer showcase team, he's not widely recruited. He's not a star. He's very good. He's growing. He's very athletic. But he doesn't get any attention from the big schools. He just doesn't play that well in the tournament. He plays okay, but not enough to get recruited. And so that eliminates all your top schools right there, all your big schools, all your Power Five schools. Nobody paid any attention to it. And as the plot develops, terrible things happen back home, and he cannot go back home because the home has been destroyed. His family has been attacked. His parents, his family is scattered, and he doesn't know where they are. And sort of as a favor, the coach at NC Central has a position, suddenly has a spare scholarship. And his my favorite character is his summer coach, Echo Lamb, who's South Sudanese, American South Sudanese, twists the arm of a friend who's the head coach at Central and says, take care of this kid. You won't be sorry. And so Suli winds up on campus in Durham, North Carolina, at the other school in Durham. And so that's how that came about.
Looking for a great dining experience in Charlottesville? Look no further than the Aberdeen Barn. The barn has been family-owned and operated since 1965, with Terry and Angela providing great atmosphere and mouth-watering food at Virginia's big-time steakhouse. Enjoy the fine dining or relax in the Sportsman's Bar, a fantastic place to wind down and socialize, surrounded by flat-screen televisions tuned to the latest sporting events. You never know who you might bump into at the Aberdeen Barn, where all the greatest Cavaliers have dined over the decades and keep coming back for the delicious menu and good times. Check it out online at aberdeenbarn.com or call 434-296-4630.
Did you want to intentionally go that route so you could also tell a story about the other side of college basketball? Because really, there's a lot of depth that you provide there about how those of us who follow the ACC, we know it's the Shangri-La of college hoops. This is the other side. I mean, it's the side where there's guarantee games. They have long bus trips. It's not the glitz and glamour that we're used to when we sit courtside either at UVA or otherwhere in the ACC.
Yeah, you know, I want to explore. I get frustrated in November, these early games that are just blowouts. I feel sorry for the other teams. You know, I don't like that part of college basketball. The first 10 games are, you know, like preseason games. There may be one serious game in there. But most of the games are sort of embarrassing. And, you know, we don't go to a lot of those games, to be honest. I get frustrated with, or we leave at halftime, we go have dinner. but the coach at NC Central, Lavelle Moten, was very cooperative. And he just said, we got to make money. You know, we got to make money. And we get paid a lot of money to go on the road and, you know, kind of sacrifice ourselves to the big schools to give them an easy win. We get a big check. That's how it goes. I mean, some of those games are worth $100,000 to a small school plus travel. So we all know that. We all know why that's why it happens. But I still don't really like that aspect of it. But the real thing I think with Central and the MEAC, their conference, was trying to capture just the spirit of how good the basketball is, how dedicated the kids are. I mean, it's real stuff. And funny things happen. A few years ago, NC State paid Central a big sum of money to drive a few miles to the PNC Center in Raleigh for an easy warm-up game in December, and Central beat the crap out of them. I love it when that happens. I love it when the walkover teams win. So it's not always a pushover.
Always refer to those in my game stories or columns as Rantha victims.
Yeah. There's a lot of descriptive terms for those games, and they're not all nice.
True. I do feel sorry for them, though. It's a tough way to go, but that's college athletics today, I guess.
It is. That's the way it is.
I was curious, you've sold over 350 million copies of your books, and they're in 45 languages, John. Have you gotten any feedback as to how this book has been welcomed in Africa? I don't know if there's any communication with anyone in Sudan that would even, it's such a mess over there. I don't know if anybody can even buy books, but.
My only contact so far with Africa, I did a couple of interviews with radio stations. I think one was a radio station, one was a newspaper in South Africa. I don't know. I mean, the books are there. There's not a big market in Africa or South America either. We don't sell a lot of books there. You know, those people are trying to survive. They can't afford to buy books. And So not much feedback there. My contract for a place like Africa is governed by the UK. I sign a contract here for the North American rights to the books, and then I sign a UK contract, and the UK covers the rest of the English-speaking world. I mean, it's the Caribbean, it's Australia, it's New Zealand, it's India. If the books are printed in English anywhere else in the world, the Brits do it. And that's just the way publishing operates. I don't know why. So the British publisher will distribute the books in Kenya, Uganda, the English-speaking African nations. And South Sudan is English-speaking as opposed to Sudan, where they speak Arabic and the religion is Islam. So that's one reason they've had civil wars there for 50 years. As far as the rest of the world, you know, basketball is popular in Europe, but it's not insanely popular like it is here. The book is a bestseller right now in the UK. The translations normally take about a year after the US publication. So the only places the books have been published are here and the UK territories. Dutch are always the fastest because they all speak English. The Dutch will come out pretty soon, if not already out. But again, it's not a big sport in Holland. Then the French, Italians, Germans, and Spanish will follow suit sometime probably next year. It's going to do okay there, but nothing like the legal thrillers.
I was just thinking it might possibly somewhere down the road inspire some other kids that might be in a similar situation or even younger that, hey, there is a chance to get out of here if I can become a really good athlete or something.
You know, Jerry, that's what's happened with basketball in these African nations. There have been so many great players come from Africa and succeed here. And these guys are like gods throughout Africa because the kids see that and they see some of the contracts that these stars sign and the endorsements and how Luol Deng, I write about him. I think it's pronounced Dung, Luol Deng. I mentioned him a while ago. I think he may have retired by now, but he had a wonderful NBA career, signed some humongous contracts to play basketball, and is a very smart guy. He kept his money and invested his money, and he's doing very well. And that's not unusual for these guys. They don't blow through the money the way other athletes are known to do. And Manute Bol, the first great South Sudanese player, made some money and was very generous. Manute Bol would actually go into the refugee camps in Uganda and Kenya, where his people were, where the South Sudanese people were, and build basketball courts. I saw a picture one time of a basketball court, an asphalt basketball court with real glass backboards that he had constructed for the kids there. So he gave his money away. He gave all his money to his people. The inspiration is there. It's a very motivating factor for these kids to pursue that. This is their game. In certain parts of Africa, soccer is still probably the biggest sport, but basketball is awfully big.
And they want to do well for themselves, but they also, you write about this a lot in the book, Suli, they want to do well for themselves so that they can bring their family with them if possible. They want to try to be able to save as many people and bring them over. And that's a key part of this book.
Suli is not sure where his mother and siblings are. His father's death was confirmed about the time he went to, in August, about the time he goes to Central and goes and starts classes. When we first see him on campus, he is a young man with very heavy burdens. He's lost his father. He's not sure where his mother and family are located. And it's not easy to find them in this age of cell phones and satellites and all this kind of stuff. It's not easy to find these people. There's so many of them. There's so many camps. They don't register. They don't sign up. They don't have IDs. Suli's family, their house was burned. His mother barely escaped with his siblings, and she left nothing behind. She had the clothes she was wearing, no money, no ID card, nothing. That's not unusual. And it's really hard to track these people down. There are some great nonprofits in this world who spend a lot of time and a lot of money helping to find the families of of people who are here, immigrants who are here, and it's a huge problem. But when we first really meet Suli on campus, he's making the best of a horrible situation, and because of his family. And then he finds out where they are. They're located. He knows his mother and two brothers are alive. His sister is probably not alive. We don't know for sure. And it's another blow to him, but he becomes determined to do whatever he can to rescue them. And because he firmly believes he can get them out of there. And he misses them greatly. And Suli's idea of therapy is to get up at 6 a.m. and go to the gym at Central and shoot buckets for 2 hours. And as he does that, he also realizes that he enjoys the weight room. And so he's pounding iron and shooting baskets. He's also growing like a weed. And before long, he becomes this incredible physical specimen. Gotta love fiction, okay? I can make this stuff up. And then he becomes a star.
Blue Ridge Bank is the proud sponsor of the Jerry Ratcliffe Show and JerryRatcliffe.com. Founded in 1893, Blue Ridge Bank has more than a century of customer-based service, but is forward-thinking and features digital banking free and available 24/7. CEO Brian Plum and his team are strong supporters of UVA Athletic. And check this out. Blue Ridge Bank is home of the $100,000 jackpot drawing to one lucky customer every year. How can you beat that? Banking smarter, simplified. Blue Ridge Bank's mission is strong customer service. Make Blue Ridge Bank your bank today. Visit mybrb.com for more information.
I'm about two-thirds of the way through. I'm from the part where he starts, he's shooting 500 jumpers a day, and he's making about a third of them. Now he's making about half of them where I am. So he's getting better. The two hours a day is working. And also his coach is impressed with how, and you mentioned the Diakite tie. Wow. I mean, Diakite, Mamadi is in the NBA shooting three-pointers now. So I can certainly see the inspiration there in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Just wait. Suli gets better and better and better.
It's looking forward to it.
Become phenomenal. He becomes the most famous basketball player in America in short order.
Well, before we switch topics to another sport, I wanted to get your reflections on some drama on Tobacco Road, your second hometown in the Atlantic Coast, Chapel Hill, when Roy surprised some of us, maybe not everybody, but in stepping down as head basketball coach at Carolina. And then following suit, I was even more surprised that Mike Krzyzewski announced this was going to be his last year at Duke. What are your thoughts on those two changes? It's monumental, I think.
One thought is over the past couple of years, Roy's had health problems. Nothing serious, I don't think. But I marvel at how Roy, Coach K, and Jim Boeheim, who's even older, can maintain the competitive energy in such a demanding sport. I mean, it's the pressure is enormous, especially at Carolina and Duke. Those two schools just expect to win every game. But it's enormous pressure. And because of the greatness of the programs and because of the expectations of the fans, it's competitive everywhere. I mean, college basketball is so super competitive. I'm surprised more coaches don't burn out. I'm surprised they made it to the age of 70 or 70 plus and still maintain, you know, the energy. I'm not sure I was surprised with Roy because the last two or three years have been pretty rough for him. He has not had the great teams. He won the title in 2017, only 4 years ago. But since then, the teams have not done that well. And a program like that, you know, if you're not winning, then life's not good. Again, Coach K is a 71, 72, I think. He seemed to be, you know, still pretty much on his game, although they didn't have a good season this year. And he's coached for 40 years, 35, 40 years is a long career in anything. So, I mean, I'm a little bit surprised, but not that surprised. What surprised me was how two legendary, storied programs could turn over the controls to two assistant coaches who have no head coaching experience. that really surprised me. And again, I don't know how you pick your successor. I don't know how a school picks a new coach. And I'm not saying they made mistakes, because we'll find out real soon if they made the right choices. Because, you know, they're going to find out real soon. As soon as the basketball starts, it'll take 2 or 3 years. But you got to succeed at those schools. You can't lose at those schools. It's very, very dicey following a legend. I watch Alabama football. You know, I'm a big SEC football fan. And when Bear Bryant finally retired, I was glad, because I lived next door in Mississippi and I was tired of being beaten every year by Alabama. But Alabama went through a 15-year period of, you know, bad coaches, bad programs, bad seasons. And that, you know, you're really playing with fire when you succeed a legend. And Roy did not have to succeed Dean Smith. You know, somebody else did. And now Hubert has got to succeed Roy. So I don't know. I kind of question the selection process. It's none of my business, because, you know, like I said, those two schools recruit themselves. I mean, there's so many kids in this country who want to play for Duke or for Carolina. They get to select. They don't recruit. They get to select who they want. And so if you're a pretty good coach and you have that type of material, you're probably going to do pretty well. It's changing. It's a big change in the ACC.
Yeah, you mentioned the Alabama situation. They even had some really good teams with 9-10 wins, but that wasn't enough.
Gene Stallings won the national title, went 11-0, beat Miami for the national title. This is probably 30 years ago. And he's a great guy. Everybody loved Gene Stallings. And the following year, he played in Starkville against my team, Mississippi State. And State won. State beats Alabama about once every 50 years. And State won the game. And the following day, there was a moving van parked in front of Gene Stallings' house. Some fan thought it was funny to send. No, they weren't amused by it. But they thought it was a cool thing to do, to park a moving van in front of Gene Stallings' house after winning a national title. And supposedly Gene said something like, "These people are nuts. I'm out of here." the expectations are, can you imagine the poor guy who's going to follow Nick Saban? Saban's had more success than Bear Bryant. It's a tough thing to do.
UVA Orthopedics and Sports Medicine boasts one of the finest teams of doctors in the country, and they're right here in Charlottesville to not only provide care for the University of Virginia athletic teams, but also the Charlottesville and Central Virginia communities. UVA Orthopedics has been a proud sponsor of the Jerry Ratcliffe Show for the past 2 years, with numerous team members featured in weekly segments where doctors share great insight into various sports injuries, what causes them, how to treat them, and recovery time. Their team of experts are there for you and offer the best care to solve your health problems and get you back on your feet. Let their team of specialists get you back in the game.
Let's move over to one of your favorite sports. It might be your favorite sport. I don't know, but I know you've been highly involved in baseball most of your life. Including generously building an incredible Little League complex in Southern Albemarle County several years ago. College baseball is heating up, man. This is the time of the year if you're a college baseball fan. And both of your alma maters are in the final 16.
Yeah, State and Ole Miss were both pretty much in the top five all year. Behind Arkansas and Vanderbilt, and both have, you know, really, really good teams, strong programs. State will host the Super this starting tomorrow, Friday, against Notre Dame, 2 out of 3. Ole Miss goes on the road to Arizona, which is going to be a tough draw. But that's, you know, that's, this is my favorite time of the year. No, March Madness is my favorite time of the year. This is my second favorite time of the year when the college baseball playoffs start, because that's kind of where I come from. When I was at Mississippi State in the late 70s, they hired a guy named Ron Polk, who had been the head coach at Georgia Southern. He was unknown, although he took Georgia Southern to Omaha. and State hired him, and he turned around a bad program in no time and began winning all the time. And the crowds, you know, mushroomed, the fans were back, and college baseball became a lot of fun for me as a student. There's a place called the Left Field Lounge at Mississippi State. It was a slight incline, and you'd park your old pickup truck on the hill and with your barbecue grill, and it was party central. I mean, we spent a lot of time out there in the games and long weekends, and I just kind of grew up with that type of love of, you know, the weekend series in college baseball. Polk turned the program around. He took the teams to Omaha. He recruited Will Clark and Rafael Palmeiro the same year in 1983. And for 3 years, we had Thunder and Lightning, Clark and Palmeiro. And they went to the College World Series, I know in 85, maybe in 84. Anyway, Polk just sort of changed the rules about college baseball. And for a while, that was State was one of the premier programs. And then LSU hired Skip Bertman in the mid-1980s, and he really electrified the game, the SEC, because he won 5 national titles. And the fan, he packed in the fans, and LSU to this day still is number one in the nation in home attendance. State and Ole Miss were in the top 5. The top 5 are LSU always, then State, Ole Miss, Arkansas, and maybe Texas or A&M. So it's all heavily SEC. The game is so popular down there. And that's kind of where I come from. And I've been to many regionals in Starkville and Oxford. I've been to Omaha several times with both teams. I went to Omaha in 2015 with my son Ty, who was UVA played Ole Miss, and Ty was wearing a UVA cap and I was wearing an Ole Miss cap. And we had a wonderful time, you know, in Omaha. I've been there many times. So I love this time of the year. I love to watch the regionals, the super regionals, and as much of Omaha as I can.
I don't know how much of this past weekend you saw in terms of Virginia's magical ride through the Columbia Regional, but some pretty nice storylines in there. It would probably stuff that would show up in one of your fictional novels.
Well, that's what I love about baseball, Jerry. It's, you know, UVA had a very mediocre season. Yeah. They struggled at the plate. Their team batting average is quite low for a college team. They have good arms. You know, they had some good weekend series and some bad weekend series. And they kind of stumble into the conference tournament, did well, got a bid, and here they are. That's college baseball. About 30 years ago, a team from Pepperdine just literally stumbled into Omaha. They got lucky and won a regional. They had not been in the top 25 all year. They had no player to get drafted. It was a good team, but nobody saw them coming. And they won the national title from Pepperdine, again, without being ranked all year. That happens in college baseball. That's why it's so much fun. It's like the Cinderella team in March Madness, somebody who can go all the way to the Final Four like Sully does. But, you know, those are the stories we love. And so the thing that gets me about UVA right now, they're playing Dallas Baptist, which is a very tough baseball school. And can you explain to me why the games are going to be in Columbia, South Carolina?
The only thing that I know is talking with the NCAA, they said that because this is a pandemic year, that only the 16 original regional sites would be eligible to host super regionals. And because since Old Dominion didn't bid and eventually lost out, I guess had they won the original bid, maybe the thing would have been in Norfolk or somewhere. But I guess since TCU, Dallas Baptist was at TCU, I don't know what the deal was there, why it wasn't played there. But I guess Columbia was the only other legitimate choice out of that 16 original sites.
It makes no sense whatsoever. It is absolutely insane to play these games in an empty stadium. I thought the pandemic was over, and we're going to watch baseball all weekend from Columbia in an empty stadium. And that takes all the fun out of the regionals. Play the game in Dallas. Dallas Baptist draws more fans than UVA. This is a red hot baseball school, has been for 20 years. They don't care about the mask or pandemic in Texas. They've been open the whole time. They don't care. Play the games or play the UVA. Play them here, but play give somebody the chance to host a super regional, a team that's deserved it, earned it the hard way. It's insane. I couldn't believe it when I saw it. I was talking to my son over the weekend, or I guess Tuesday morning when UVA qualified. And I said, well, I'm sure the games are going to be either in Charlottesville or Dallas. And he said, I don't think so. And we went back and forth and searched online. And once we realized the game's going to be back in Columbia, it is insane. You cannot justify that decision at any level. And it's really frustrating. Because we're going to watch these games, two or three games, depending on how far it goes, in an empty stadium, a big empty stadium. So, you know, it's very frustrating.
Yeah. I mean, it was really sad to see that Columbia Stadium seats at least 7,000 people. Yeah. And after South Carolina lost, there was nobody there.
Yeah.
And you're right, that was sad. I hated to see that.
You see it all the time in the regionals when the home team gets knocked out, the fans disappear. And I've done that myself at Mississippi State and Ole Miss. When they lose the first two games, everybody goes home. But you have to finish the weekend. But don't send – if you have a choice, don't send the games to an empty stadium. It just anyway, it's a bad decision made by somebody. I hope they take another look at it and figure out some way to – I guess all 64 teams are not seeded. Maybe that's too difficult. But if you come down to UVA and Dallas Baptist, the top-seeded team gets to host or something like that. It should be fairly simple or maybe the team that puts in the best bid. A lot of money involved here. For years, Mississippi State and LSU would bid every year for a regional because they had the fans and they had the money. And they would put in big bids and get the kind of a funny story. Probably 10 years ago, State had a mediocre season, won the conference tournament, put in a big bid for a regional and got it because of the money. And Clemson deserved the regional, didn't get it. And they sent Clemson to Mississippi State. And in the first two games there, State set a record, attendance record for college baseball regional games. I think it was 13,000 in the first game and 12,000 in the second game. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that's the type of fan support you have there. Point is, they got the regional because they had the money or they could put up the money. And that could be done here. I mean, UVA or Dallas Baptist would be happy to put up the money to get the host. So again, it doesn't make sense anywhere.
I naively thought Monday night when our game got rained out and saw that Dallas Baptist had beaten Oregon State. It was just like 2015 when Virginia beat USC out there and then UCLA lost to Maryland out there and they had to come back across the country. And we got a surprise super regional in Charlottesville in 2015. I just naively assumed that it would be the same thing here. And plus, you got to think about all the money the NCAA has given up here. I mean, just 5,000 tickets per week, per game, two games, $20 a ticket. That's a couple hundred thousand bucks. Nobody can turn down money except for the NCAA, apparently.
All right, we beat them up enough. We beat up the NCAA again. We'll never get tired of doing it, okay? It's always fun.
Absolutely. One guy that would have made a great fictional character for one of your books, maybe someday down the road, was Stephen Schock, the big donkey from Virginia. Did you get to see his interviews with, the ACC Network? I think it's over 1 million views now.
I missed the whole story. What is it? I missed it.
He's just quite a character. He's a big old burly relief pitcher. Beard, long hair. They compared him to Kenny Powers. I don't know if you're familiar with him, another fictional baseball character on HBO, but it's third school. He's a six-year senior.
Isn't he
almost unhittable?
One of his schools was UMBC. Is that right, Jerry? I think I have that right.
Yeah, he came here from UMBC.
That's an interesting connection.
After that first relief appearance when he did so well, if anything's scares him, and he said caves. he said somebody in the Old Dominion crowd, I think it was maybe a South Carolina crowd, tried to bribe him to give up a home run and they would buy him some Dippin' Dots. And he said, well, I was thinking about it for a while, but because I really love Dippin' Dots. But he said, you know, I thought, well, if we win today, my per diem, I get another day of per diem, I can buy my own Dippin' Dots and I can be a winner. And it just kept on and on and on. It was just one of the greatest interviews of all time.
I'm sure it's on YouTube. I'll go find it.
Yeah, you'll definitely enjoy it. Anything else from you, Chris?
No, just the recommendation that, yes, you have to catch up with Stephen Schock and to familiarize yourself with Kenny Powers. I wouldn't recommend too much, John, maybe necessarily. I mean, it was the show called Eastbound and Down on HBO. He is definitely Kenny Powers' love child. So maybe watch one episode of that if you have any, if you have 30 minutes to kill. Stephen Schock is a character. I'm sure he's large. He's too large for life, though, for even fiction, I think, at this stage. He might be difficult to bring into a book.
I'll check him out. Everything's fair game for writers, okay?
That's true.
Every person, every scene, every word, everything is going to be remembered by a writer somewhere. And we steal ideals, stories, names, plots. That's what we do.
Well, thank you so much, John Grisham. I know you and Jerry know each other. It's great for me to be able to talk with you. So thank you for your time. From my perspective, I just want to thank you profusely for joining us here on the podcast.
My pleasure. Before I go, Jerry, a little bit of nostalgia here. You mentioned my ballpark down in the southern part of the county. To keep things in perspective about our ages, Cove Creek Park opened in 1996, 25 years ago. And you were down there with a photographer, and you the headlines and the progress was Grisham opens Cove Creek to rave reviews or something like that. It was a very nice story with color photographs. I've saved it. I've got it in the archives, but that was 25 years ago. And we were worried about, because it's, you know, pretty rural, we were worried about getting enough kids to play there. And that wasn't the problem. We had within a couple of years, we had to limit the enrollment to 500 kids to allow teams enough practice time and all that. And so for years we had waiting lists to get in. Well, what's happened, as you know, with baseball, kids are not playing baseball anymore. And the numbers are down nationwide. Little League is having a real problem with, the decline of baseball. That's a big factor. We certainly felt that at Cove Creek Park. And also the proliferation and popularity of travel ball. The kids are traveled, you know, nowadays a kid picks a sport at the age of 10 and he plays it year round. He or she plays it year round. And so it takes a lot of fun out of recreational ball. So you got the competing interest between rec ball and competitive ball. And so rec always loses. So we're down a fair number of players. We still have leagues in softball and t-ball every year, but you ought to come down and see the place 25 years later. It's even prettier than it was 25 years ago.
I'll have to do that. I really will. It'd be a nostalgic visit for sure. I was very impressed that the first day we went out there, we had tried to do an interview twice and we got snowed out. It was that early in the year. And it was before they had ever really done any real construction. And so when I finally made it out there, we spent most of the afternoon on a gator going through the mud. But what I was really impressed with was when it did finally open, guess who was out there cleaning off the base paths and lining the field, Chris?
I think I read the story that John referenced there, so I know the answer to that. I'm not giving away anything when I say that. Yeah, it was John Grisham out there doing all that hard work. Yes.
Yes, it was.
Back then, I could lay chalk without a string in a straight line from home to first. I can't do it now. I had so much practice.
That was pretty good. I was impressed because. A lot of guys in your position would have gotten somebody else to do it, but you were out there right in the middle of it. That just shows your love for the passion for the game and for kids. So I appreciated that. Thank you so much, John, for spending part of your day with us. It's a memorable interview. I'm sure it's going to be a great hit with our listeners, and we appreciate your time. And I'll come down and visit.
Listen, always fun for me. We'll do it again. Let's do it in the fall and preview college basketball or something like that. Catch up with football and preview basketball.
Absolutely.
Anytime. You know where to find me.
Thank you for listening to the Jerry Ratcliffe Show. Get the latest on the Hoos, basketball, football, and more online at jerryratcliffe.com or at augustafreepress.com.